Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more. Welcome back to Cutting the Distance. Today we're recording here at the 2023 Pendleton Roundup with Pendleton Whiskey in the 1910 room. I have to admit, I'm not much of a cowboy, but I love watching all the events, and I just like being around good people, which you're surrounded by at these rodeos. Today's guest is a Canadian professional rodeo cowboy who specializes in saddle bronc riding. He's a three-time 2016, 19, and 22 Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association world champion saddle bronc rider. Additionally, he spent some time in the fall hunting a little, and everything that Canada has to offer, whitetail, elk, mule deer, moose, coyotes, whatever he has a tag for there on his place. Welcome to the show, Zeke.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited for this.
How's it going here for you at the Pendleton Rodeo?
It's been really good. We showed up Monday. Slack started. We was in the team roping. Didn't have any luck there. I rode my bronc on Wednesday. It's 86, so we'll be back for the finals on Saturday.
Perfect. When you come to these rodeos, are there guys that only do, you know, single events, or are there a lot of guys that do a little bit of everything like you, like roping, riding?
They're kind of a little bit of both, but mostly anymore, rodeo's gotten to where it's kind of every event's pretty specialized. One guy's kind of throw all their eggs in one basket, you know. But there are all around guys, obviously. They give away an all around world title, probably the most coveted title to get, which is Stetson Wright's been winning the last few years. But there are lots of timed event guys cross over from calf rope to team rope and stuff like that. We enter this one every year, just gives away a really cool all around saddle, and it's just it's pretty fun to run one down on the grass.
Yeah. So normally at this time in the podcast, we would take listener questions. And if you have listener questions of your own, feel free to email them to us at ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com or hit us up on social. But today I'm going to take this 15 minutes or so and just ask Zeke some questions about the rodeo, you know, kind of his life and how you get here. So we're going to do a little pivot, and then we'll get back to our normal recordings in future episodes. How do you become a pro rodeo cowboy? I'm having kind of second thoughts on what my career choice should be, and so I'm really curious for myself. How do you become a pro rodeo cowboy?
Yeah, it's kind of an unconventional way to make a living, and there's lots of different ways to become a rodeo cowboy. Some of the guys that we ride with just fall into it and see it on TV or something, you know, catch it somewhere and think that's one of the cooler things I've ever seen and somehow get involved. For me, personally, both sides of my family have always been very deeply rooted in rodeo and stuff, so I just grew up in it. I grew up on a ranch in Big Valley, Alberta, and just pretty pretty well just grew up in it. It's all I can ever remember.
Yeah. So does that start like at a very young age? Like when, what's the progression? It's like, you know, at our local fair, there's like mutton bus, you know, they throw them on a sheep. So it's like, how do you progress through like when you're ready to get on an animal, like how you finally get on a bronc and, you know, how does that go?
Yeah, it's a little different for everybody, but obviously, you know, being ranch kids, we rode anything that we could get on, you know, the goats and bottle calves and everything that was around the place. But yeah, there are stepping stones. You know, obviously the sheep riding's, I think that's more for the parents' enjoyment, but yeah. You know, you can go that route, and then you obviously probably start riding a saddle horse and learning to ride and things, and then progress into, say, steer riding if you wanted to go that route, or you start roping, and just kind of go through the steps until you're where you want to be.
Yeah, this is not meant to insult anybody, but I was talking with Garrett Long with Meat Eater. He's here at the Roundup with us, and we were talking about, like, you know, the extreme bulls, the bull riding versus bronc, and kind of the tradition and where that came from. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Like, the bulls have kind of maybe been for a little bit more show and entertainment, where bronc really has their tradition rooted into it.
Yeah, so the bronc riding is what they call the event that started it all. It's kind of the very first, 150 years ago, there would be, say cowboys like at the Pendleton Roundup, when they'd have a roundup, they get everybody's cattle together and brand and then sort them off. And then you take your own cattle and go sell them. Is how they used to do it. So at the roundups, whoever had the bronkiest or rankest horse that they were riding, obviously they would start putting wagers on it and bets, being cowboys, yep, and seeing who could ride the longest on the rankest horse. And that's kind of where it started. And the bull riding, I think it came around after. Kind of more as a WWE type.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. Because, I mean, what you guys were doing was, you know, trying to break crazy horses.
Pretty relevant to the ranching type. Yeah, Western way.
Where there was no reason you should jump on a bull and never try to stay on
bull around in a pasture. No.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So, you know, for me, maybe a little bit of an outsider, like, we know there's this local circuit. You know, I've got the St. Paul Rodeo close to me, you know, the mm-hmm. Pendleton Roundup. So there's, but when people typically think, you know, rodeos, they think of the NFR. They think about the pro rodeo. But the PRCA rodeos all lead up to this actual NFR. And can you tell us how that goes? How many of these, you know, I don't want to say minor events because they're not, but how many of the PRCAs do you hit in order to make it to the NFR? And then can you tell us how you actually, like, qualify for the NFR?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're what you would call like a regular season rodeo. I think the PRCA has somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 and some regular season rodeos every year. Our season starts October 1st and ends September 30th. And so you just, for us, mostly we start in January. We kind of, when the building rodeos, big winter rodeos start and stuff. So that's kind of when we start, and we'll go all the way to the end of September. In the bronc riding, you're allowed to use 100 rodeos towards your count and qualifications for the NFR. NFR is strictly top 15 in the world off money won. So the 15 guys that win the most money in that event are seeded in to go play at the finals.
So the most, if you happen to go to 100 events and win money at it, they're taking your top 100 winnings, calculating that, and then that's what determines the 15 that get to make it to Vegas in December every year.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Gotcha. So I was completely, you know, hopefully everybody knows it was a joke. I never belong on a bronc or a bull ever. Another thing that would keep me off, I'm not tough enough. One thing that people think about with rough stock is injuries. How's your career been in that sense so far? I believe you're 29 years old.
I'm 29. Yeah. And as far as injuries go, I've been really lucky. It's a pretty rough sport. All three of the rough stock events, you know, you're dealing with an animal that outweighs you 10 times, you know, and so you can get banged up, but that's kind of part of it. You know, if you're gonna jump dirt bikes or ride buck and bulls, you're probably gonna get some bumps and bruises.
Yeah. And one thing, the injuries seem to differ between broncs and bulls, where, you know, they twist you off, you go flying typically, and they want to stomp on you. Where, you know, watching yesterday a little bit, it seems like, you know, you guys fall off a little more graceful. I mean, they can be some pretty bad tumbles, but there's a big difference between kind of how you crash on bulls versus how you crash on the broncs.
Yeah, the bronc riding, it's pretty You know, it's all timing and balance. All the events are, but the Bronc Riding, they say it's kind of like poetry in motion, I guess is what they call it all the time. Yeah. So it's when it's working, it's really smooth, and it looks really good. It's really not rough at all. You obviously you will get banged up and, yep. and get into some wrecks and situations where you know it's unavoidable. For the most part, it's you're not really going to get too big of wrecks, but knees, ankles, and groins are pretty hard for Bronc riders. Yeah, they go a lot.
Yeah. I think I've seen more people get banged up off of the dismount. You know, they get the rescue horse or whatever it is.
Yeah,
comes and gets him off his horse, and then they seem to tumble off the other side or end up on their knees.
Yeah, that's where I usually get all my injuries.
trying to get off safely.
Yeah.
As far as the crossover, you know, I make my living as a hunter. You make your living as a rodeo guy. Do you think there's a big crossover between the two groups? And you know,
I personally, I've seen a huge crossover my whole life. Most everybody that I know that through the rodeo world, you know, is involved in hunting or fishing, some sort of conservation, you know, of some sort.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, it could be just ranching, you know, taking care of their place and stuff. But huge crossover. A lot of the contestants are big hunters. Some of them have their own outfits and guides. There's a lot of hunting goes on in the rodeo side.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of crossover in the two genres or whatever you want to call them, the two lifestyles. Mm-hmm. Definitely have a lot of crossover.
I think they complement each other quite well. And you know, a lot of people that come from rodeo, not everybody, but comes from like a ranch or a farm or, you know, some sort of agricultural background. And a lot of times with that comes, you know, harvesting animals off your own land.
One of the things that, you know, here at Meat Eater, we're huge public land advocates, you know, and I love it. But one thing we need to do is tip our hat to, you know, a lot of the private land, you know, these ranchers, these cowboys that run big chunks of private, they seem to take care of the animals maybe better than we can on the public, you know, and give them the things they need, you know, food, water, you know, all of that. And there hasn't been too many places I've went where the private land hunting wasn't maybe a little better than the public that's adjacent to it. So, you know, we always talk about conservation, but it's like these private landowners, all the work they're doing for their livestock also benefits wildlife in an incredible way.
Oh, for sure. Lots of our neighbors and people around us, you know, they run cattle and do all that, but they also, you know, sell hunts in the fall and like to take care of their deer and animals because they, you know, it's also another source of income.
Yep. So what's your biggest and favorite pro rodeo moment if you had to pick one?
Oh, my probably last year, I would say it was my favorite moment, 10th round of the NFR. I had one ride that it won me a lot. Set a season's earning record, tied the average record, won the world, won the average, split the round, and was the Top Gun winner at the NFR. So
nice.
That was pretty cool. I don't know if that'll all happen ever again.
Yeah. One good ride just kind of checked all the boxes there for you.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So now we're going to jump in. We're going to transition a little bit from the rodeo into hunting. So as I mentioned earlier, it sounds like you hunt a little bit of everything up there. And that's one thing I love about Canada is like you got everything on the table. You know, you've got elk, you've got mule deer, whitetail, moose, you got predator hunting. What would be your favorite of the species to go after? Do you have one?
I don't know. I would, my favorite is probably hunting elk, obviously, when you're running around, they're all screaming and stuff. But I just like it. I really just like to be outside and enjoy it. But it's mule deer hunting. They're all different, you know.
Yep.
It's fun to put a stock on a mule deer. Or you sit in your tree stand, wait for your whitetail to come by. It's I like them all.
So how are you able to? We'll get back to the rest of the species and strategy and all of that. But how do you balance your schedule with, you know, being on the road quite a bit? Because what the rodeoing stops at the end of September, so you're about to have a little bit of a fall break leading into the NFR. Then
yes, sir. Yeah, we'll still have a few more to go to, a few more events and things. But that is our slowest time. Yeah,
that's perfect. So you have a little bit of your fall to hunt if you need to, and take care of the place while you're there. And so end of September, you're still riding through then. Do you get to catch some of that elk rut, or are you typically hunting them with a rifle or a bow up there? How does that, like, how does your guys' season structure set up there in Canada? And then what you know, how do you hunt elk, whether screaming, whether it's with a rifle, and kind of what's your fall lookout?
Yeah, so I kind of usually miss most of the good part of the rut by the time we get home from this.
Yep.
But yeah, we'll go after them with our bow. For an antlered elk, it's a draw tag in our area for a rifle. Me and my brother had one last year. He killed a pretty nice bull there. And yeah, so then I got a draw tag for mule deer this year. So
oh, nice.
Imagine nice. We'll try to go kill something.
When's that season run?
So that's, I can archery hunt him, and then November 1st turns into a rifle tag.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah. So where you're at in Canada, are you in mountainous ground? Are you hunting them up in the mountains, or do you have some, you know, foothills that kind of surround the place?
Yeah, so where I'm at, I'm actually kind of right in the start of the prairies. So I'm in the prairies that kind of runs through the southeastern side of Alberta. Lots of little rolling hills, little bluffs of poplar trees and willows. Lots of, you know, we got so many hills, we got lots of little, we call them sloughs or yeah. whatever, but you know,
little
they
coolies.
Dry. Yeah. They dry up on dry years, but, lots of years they hold water. And, yeah, it's actually pretty cool country right off the river. Red Deer River runs there. It's got big river breaks, kind of badlandsy, you know?
Nice,
so
nice.
It's,
I love that country.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's pretty.
So, whitetail as well. Mm-hmm. Now you can hunt whitetail every single year up there in
yes,
Canada.
Sir, yeah.
So what's your go-to tactic on that? Are you guys more spot and stalk? Are you sitting in a tree stand, a ground blind? Like, what's your go-to? You know, are you patterning on them, or like what's your go-to there?
Yeah. So for us, it's mostly you kind of get in a stand or in a ground blind or wherever, and you just kind of hang out. Like for where our whitetail are. It's a few miles north of our place where it starts to get quite a bit, you know, you start to get into quite a bit more cover and, yep. and brush and stuff. The country gets a little tougher, you know? So they're not as visible where, I think the mule deer have kind of pushed them out over the years. Cause it seemed like you used to catch them out in the open a lot more, but, we just, you know, you just sit in a stand or whatever,
and,
dry years so you can sit on water and.
Yeah. Do you play whitetails during the rut, or are you trying to do like that pre-rut and pattern them, or are you hunting them during the
rut? Yeah, we hunt them during the rut. We'll try to rattle them in.
Rattling. Yeah, do you do any calling as far as like grunting, bleeding?
Just a little bit. Mostly like I'm not confident enough in my calling. To, you know, if I need to stop one or
gotcha.
Something, that's about all I use it
yeah.
for.
Yeah, I'm pretty new to whitetailing. I always everybody still kind of jokes with me because I always said I would whitetail hunt when I turned 70 and couldn't walk around in the mountains anymore, but I got to go to Kansas last year. You know, all the listeners have heard this before, but I was surprised, you know, with some of our new grunt calls that we had put out, you know, hunting around blacktails. We have blacktails here on the coast, and just how effective it was, almost as effective as calling elk, you know, just
really?
A little grunt, you know, some popping grunts,
yeah.
Some tending grunts, and we had bucks come flying at us, and then a couple times we would get up, we had some elevated ground blinds, we weren't down on the ground, but to hit the rattle bag, and just to have bucks come running like
yeah.
out of multiple directions,
yeah.
you know, kind of like sprinting by us. It was a lot of fun.
That's
so I was,
cool, yeah.
yeah and I honestly, I'm not telling you how to hunt, but I think if you picked up a grunt call, like it's super easy
oh,
to
I'd
use.
I'd love to have somebody
and
show me how to,
well,
you know.
I know a guy. I'll have
I don't
to,
know what I'm saying to them with it.
No, yeah, I don't think you have to. There's some popping grunts, some little
yeah.
short ones, and then you get that longer tending grunt. That's all I ever did, and had great success with it.
Nice,
so,
nice. Yeah, we'll have to get on that.
Yeah, I know a guy. I'll get some sent to you,
and
you can give him a run this year. Mule deer, you all spot and stalk, or what's your approach there?
Yeah, usually, and most seems like if we do, if we're hunting mule deer, it's usually with a rifle. We'll just buy a landowner's tag or something, just to have something to go hunt.
Yep.
But yeah, usually just spot and stalk. Me and my brother, actually, we killed a pretty good mule deer a couple years ago. And yeah, it's kind of fun. We got family close by, and you know, we get up in the morning, go out for a couple hours, and same in the evening.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of a long family tradition. You guys have hunted that country for a long, long time.
Yeah, I grew up with two brothers, and so all three of us boys were pretty close in age and obviously had the same interests and
yep.
stuff. So
yep. So are you guys, and I might, this might lend to me not knowing exactly how Canada's laid out. You know, some of those areas in Alberta and Saskatchewan just got giant mule deer. You know, you see the mm-hmm. giants that lay down on the wheat fields
yep.
or the cornfields. Are you guys in that part of the country where they grow just the giant?
I mean, they
Canadian
get
bugs?
They get pretty big. So my uncle last year, just north of us, He lives north of Stettler. We live south of Stettler. He killed, I didn't hear of any in Alberta going much bigger, but he killed a mule deer that went 213.
Jeez, that's a giant.
Pretty good. The one that me and my brother killed year before last, he went 198. Yeah. So like pretty good deer. You get east of us over there, kind of along on the Saskatchewan border and stuff, they can run into some big mule deer, yeah. You know, big crankers down there.
So I have to ask, maybe you don't want to...
The hunting's pretty good everywhere in Canada. Like, it's not really that bad. Yeah. It's not that bad.
Is there just not as much competition? And maybe you don't know our atmosphere down here. It just seems like the competition for the good takes is just crazy down here versus up there. It doesn't seem to be as much for the...
I think it's just the population size and things. Like, you know, you go to Alberta, there's 4 million people in Alberta, and it's got a bigger landmass than Texas.
Yeah.
You know, where you go to Texas, there's 30 million people. You know, that's a lot more people after something. I think that's kind of what it is. Bigger, just... It's a vast country and lots of animals.
Yeah, you might not want people to know this if the answer is what you're going to tell me it is. But how would a guy like me being down here in the States? How do we hunt Canada? You'd mentioned neighboring property selling hunts. Mm-hmm. Is there
you'd have to go through a licensed guide of some sort and there's over the counter tags and different things you can buy. Probably not a lot different than me coming down here.
Gotcha. So you can go up there, you can get an over-the-counter tag, but you just need to find property to hunt, or you'd need to be with a guide.
You would have to go. I think there's some sort of regulation on having to go through a guide, and you like to have proof that you're up there, not to go mess around.
Yeah, you're not up there without reason.
Yeah.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there because they're great and they're super friendly and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time. Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way that they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
You mentioned yesterday, we got to talk a little bit yesterday at the meat eater booth here at the rodeo. Coyote hunting. It sounds like you maybe do just as much of that as big game, and you enjoy that. What's your go-to there? Are you using e-calls? Are you using?
Yeah, hand calls, electric calls, Fox Pro, whatever. We yeah, we kind of hunt them, however we can. There's Alberta's littered with coyotes. There's coyotes everywhere. Yeah. You know, the last whatever few years, the fur trade's been pretty poor. So there, I mean, it seems like there's becoming even more of them because you know they're not really in demand. And but that's something my dad got us boys into when we were quite young, and you know, took us out and called us in a coyote, and we all got hooked. And so it's pretty fun wintertime pastime, you know.
Yep. Yep. Did that come out of the farming ranching lifestyle? Like, do they harass your animals, or was it not that bad, or it just kind of keeps them off the landscape, or was it?
Oh, you gotta control them to some extent. You know, for us, it was never that, you know, they were
harassing
hard on livestock or you know, seems like every year they get in my wife's chicken coop and wreak havoc on the chickens. Yeah, like, that's about it. That's but just did it, you know, for something to do and, you know, keep them in check, keep everything. Yeah.
The decline in the fur trade is a big issue with depredation everywhere because, you know, back in the day, when I say back in the day, maybe just 20 or 30 years ago when the hide prices were high, you know, raccoons, beavers, you know, coyotes, you had a lot of guys out there with dogs, you know, spending time willing to put gas in their gas tank, you know, which like on the wild turkey population is huge to keep those raccoons out and, you know, all of that. And it seems like with the fur trade and the fur prices being driven down, you know, nobody's on the landscape anymore keeping the raccoons off of there or the coyotes. And, and it just, nobody's willing to spend that kind of money. You know, it seems like there's a select few that are still out doing it.
You're kind of doing it at your own expense anymore. That not too many ladies in New York wearing fur anymore.
Yep.
So
just a few.
Yeah. It, you know, which is kind of a shame cause there is a place, you know, for it, but, you know, we just hunt them for fun and, you know, there's a lot of them around.
Yeah.
By us anyway.
Yeah, it seems like anytime you get around an ag-rich environment, it's overran, what I would consider overran. You know, I don't claim to be a biologist, but just more than what's needed on the landscape.
Just opportunists to hunters, right?
Yeah.
So
there's more on the landscape.
Get somebody with a feedlot that's got a dead pile out back.
You're good to go.
Easy meal.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to switch all the way back. We're going to come back to elk hunting, rutting elk. So you're going to get back kind of at that tail end, but what's your approach to rutting elk? Are you running ridges to locate them? Are they in the bottomlands? Are they just like in set area? Because you guys are pure Rockies where you're at, right? No roads.
Yeah. So where we hunt the elk though, like I said, we're in the prairies there, so it's pretty tricky.
Wide open.
You got to get in some sort of cover and hopefully get a crosswind and get them coming by you. We don't get a ton of area to hunt them either, and they move so much, you know, back and forth and stuff. But they're tricky to hunt around us for sure. But you know, with the rifle, you have a pretty decent chance. Even then, it's not easy.
Yeah, and so we talked about it on episode, I believe it was 49 with Corey Calkins, who used to guide on some private land. You just mentioned you guys have a pretty small area, so. Where, you know, a lot of what I teach in the mountains here where you've got endless public is we put quite a bit of pressure on them at times. Mm-hmm. Where in the situation where you are, or even if you find yourself in a public situation where you don't want to move these elk out of that area, you guys are probably a little more reluctant to put a bunch of pressure on them during archery season because you need them to be on the piece of land you can hunt. You want them to feel comfortable there. You want them to know that you're not existing so that you can hunt them day after day and they're not moved on to the neighbors or a different piece, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then once we get into October, you know, you kind of you still get, you know, there's kind of a second phase to the rut and stuff, or, you know, at the end you might catch two or three bulls that are kind of hanging out, you know, starting to group back up. And but it is tricky around, like, it's not like you can just go hike 4 miles and get around them and stuff, you know, because that's your neighbors and your neighbors over there hunting too.
So you guys might all be buddies until it's elk season. You guys are all buddies until it becomes elk season and the elk are on his property and then he doesn't want you over there.
They're all pretty good. Everybody's actually, last year when we killed that bull, the neighbor was across, you know, about a mile away on his stuff, and he was watching them too. He heard the shots and come over, and he was all excited we got one.
Awesome.
They're hunting the same thing.
Yeah. So one thing that, you know, as far as archery elk hunting, you know, wind is kind of king, right? It controls everything. What does the wind, like, you know, prairie hunting seems to be frustrating because in the mountains I've got thermals, I've got some prevailing winds, mm-hmm. I've got stuff that's pretty, I can set my watch to it, you know, where when you guys are out in the prairie, is it more sporadic or is it pretty is it pretty predictable as far as like
wind,
how you're
wind,
gonna...
Wind blows usually pretty good, usually out of the north northwest a lot, but if you get down in one of them low spots in like a slough bottom or something, you know, you usually got two or three hillsides around you, you know, you get in there and the wind changes direction on you all the time, swirls and stuff. So yeah, I need to go with somebody like you and have them get one in my lap, because haven't had a ton of luck yet.
Yeah, we might have to plan that. Like, I love hunting in the mountains where I can use the terrain and the vegetation to like mask my movement. Yeah. You know, I'm a little bigger than you, so it's like I need all the advantage I can get. You know, if I was me sneaking around,
I haven't even got to go to the mountains and do any elk hunting. Oh, like, you'd that love would, it. Yeah, that would be something.
We'll have to talk to Garrett and see if we can't get something scheduled.
That's right.
So, prairie, is there any cover at all? Like, are there tree rows? Are there, you know, fence rows? Do you have anything, or is it just wide open and you have
there's lots of, like, so, like, little pop, like, I don't know, they're a variety of poplar tree, but they don't get super tall. They're more of a weed. They, like, the root systems are all connected. They grow real fast, take on lots of water, and I don't think they live real long. But there's some little poplar trees, so they get like 30 some feet tall. So there's a lot of those around. You can get in those and the willows, and you know, yeah, there's cover for sure.
So that's where those elk. So they'll come out. Correct me if I'm wrong. They'll come out, feed in the prairie in the ag, and then they're gonna go back and bed in these small brush thickets.
So off the river. So we live about 4 miles off the river, and the river valley, the river breaks are huge. Like it's a mile to the bottom on each side. And so the elk will get down in the river, and then they'll come up out of the river, and then they'll come across to anybody's alfalfa or oats and barley, whatever. They get up there and get a feed, and that's when we hunt them.
Yep.
And then they usually drop down in the river.
So when they're up there in that feed, you're just trying to find little crevices and stuff where you can make movement and get close. It just seems like a very, very tough way. It's a tough way to hunt elk, especially if they're in...
Tough way, and then you get down in there and... get all them little hills around you and stuff, and you can't hear where
the eyes are going to be.
You don't know.
What herd sizes do you guys run up there? Because, you know, it varies where we hunt. You know, where I'm from, we have Roosevelt on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
The herd sizes, they used to be, until our numbers are so down right now, you know, they used to carry herds of 20, 25 elk. And, you know, where you're at, I can imagine all those eyes on you, you know, versus somewhere hunting the mountain, sometimes it's one bull to two or three cows.
Yeah.
Like, what's the herd sizes there? And then how many eyes are you having to deal with as well?
Yeah,
as being
like,
in this?
Them elk that my brother was, he was in the middle of last year when he killed that bull, like, I would say there was... I took a video. There's probably 40 some head.
So they're running pretty big
right
herds.
Around 40, yeah. So there really didn't used to be any elk around us around Big Valley. Say 15, 20 years, like when I was a little kid, like there wasn't really any elk. You know, in the last whatever amount of years they've come back, they used to be, but hadn't been for a long time. Anyways, they're back, and I would say, I don't know, like there's a couple different herds of, you know, you can see 60, 70 elk at a time, and there's two or three different herds running around, so.
Do I call them ranchers, farmers, whoever farms all the country there, are they happy the elk are there? Are they becoming kind of a pain with the population growing like it is for you guys?
Yeah, for us, they're not, they don't, you know, really, really cause too much havoc. They're pretty good. I think some of the neighbors, they might get in some of their silage pits and stuff, eat on a little feed and stuff, but I don't, I haven't really heard. It's not like you get down there around like Sheridan, Wyoming or somewhere, and the elk are half tame, you know, and they get in people's stack yards and wipe out tons and tons of stuff, you know.
So you guys, with the reintroduction, I say reintroduction, there may have been some around, but, you know, like with them showing back up in bigger numbers, it hasn't been like a...
They say the wolves moved them off the foothills of the mountains and they've come east and stuff.
Gotcha. They're finding better country where the wolves don't necessarily want to be.
Yeah.
So do you guys have wolves where you're at, or not yet?
No,
or not in high density?
No, you wouldn't see wolves around us, no.
Gotcha.
The odd bear, you see a lion and stuff on the river. Stuff, but
I was going to ask about bears. Do you guys have much bear that country?
You'll see like the odd bear will follow that river up, you know, traveling, whatever, but never really sticking around.
Yep. Moose, is that, I'm assuming that's a draw, or can you guys hunt those every year? How does your moose hunting?
Moose is a draw tag. I think you're an eight on that. So yeah, you put in for 8 or 9 years before
you get
a moose tag. But lots of moose around. Some pretty good moose. Me and my brother killed a pretty good bull 2019.
Gotcha.
You know, for a prairie moose, he was like 52 inches.
Nice. So you guys, and I don't, I'm gonna also expose, since I've never moose hunted, you've got the Yukon way up north, you know, your big Alaskan Yukon moose. And then, you know, I know we got our Shiras here in like Washington. Now you guys have like what they consider Canadian, or you just mentioned them being prairie moose.
Yours are like a Shiras, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Yours are Shiras as well.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so 52-inch bulls, I mean, really good bull for
it's not huge by no means, but for around us, pretty decent moose.
Yeah, cool. On those, are you guys hunting them during the rut, or are you guys spotting stalking those, or on that sort of hunt, are you limited?
Yeah, it's usually a rifle tag, so you're just spotting stock. And November, November hunting them.
Gotcha. You know, are those on your property, or when you draw a moose tag, do you start to get permission from some of the neighboring properties?
Yeah, because they come around so rarely. Like, you pretty well, you ask your neighbors, and whatever neighbor that year has the tag, you kind of have permission.
It's a community permission where, because you know not everybody's going to have one in the same year.
You know who's got the tag, and you got full permission to shoot wherever you want.
So if you could only hunt, what's your favorite? We've talked about everything you get to hunt in Canada. It sounds like
I would have to say elk. I would say elk would probably be my favorite, but I don't know. I like it. I like it all. Yeah, it's all pretty fun.
Yeah, I love elk just for the interaction. You know,
just
the rut, being able to call these things. You know, have a 700-800 pound mm-hmm. screaming animal coming in, you know, pissed off at you.
It's just so vocal, and it's awesome.
I'm chomping at the bit. You know, we're here. It is September 15th, and you know, we're here at the Pendleton Rodeo, and
talking about
the bulls in these hills about 3 minutes behind us are just cranking. And, I love the rodeo, but there's a piece of me that really wants to be in the mountains right now. So I'm trying to balance this issue I'm going through right now. So it sounds like, as we talked about, you get to hunt a little bit of everything in Canada, have a lot of fun doing it. There's definitely a correlation between the cowboys, the rodeo fans, the ranch lifestyle, and hunting, which I really admire and I like that. Like I say, it's the rodeo seems to be full of good people. Everybody you meet here, somebody would give you the shirt off their back. You know, good wholesome quality people.
Salt of the earth.
I love. Salt of the earth type of people. So I'm gonna roll back. We're gonna kind of close with back to the rodeo cowboy and stuff. So Garrett Long here with Meat Eater was telling me that his uncle back in the day kind of hired you when you were younger to do some trick riding. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that is?
Yeah, for sure. So when I was about nine, we started, me and my two brothers started this little trick riding kind of Western show type act, and we'd go around to the rodeos and do it. It was a little trick riding, a little trick roping. You spin the rope and do tricks with it. Whip cracking, and then Roman riding, which is where you stand on the back of the two horses and you go around. We go over a jump or whatever. Anyway, so we had a little show, and we went around all over North America, you know, performing at rodeos. And Garrett's uncle hired us. We did the Wolf Point Rodeo. Did some really really cool things. We got to perform for the Queen of England and for the Princess Kate and the prince, and met a lot of cool people, and got to do pretty cool things as a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. And so when does trick riding like give way to the real rodeo stuff? Was there a point like, all right, I'm done doing this trick ride, I need to get on a bronc?
Yeah, it was pretty cool when we were little, and then as we did it from the time I was 9 till about 14, I think, or 13, somewhere in there. But we did it for 3 or 4 years there, and it was really good. But yeah, once we started getting a little older and going on to some different things, we kind of phased out.
Yeah. So one thing, my wife thinks I'm on the road a lot, but I have to imagine, listening to your schedule, you're on the road a whole lot. How many days a year would you say you're traveling to rodeos or doing, you know, at rodeos, and then between being home?
Between, I would, it's somewhere between 200 and between 230 to 250 days a year, you're probably gone.
So you're home 110 to 130 days.
I spend a lot more time with my family than a lot of people. I have a place in Texas that we go and spend the winter at, and they come with me when we're at the winter rodeos. But if it wasn't for that, we'd get about 60 days
year at home. So what's the balance? I know your kids are here with you at this one, and Garrett had really commended you on, like, you know, taking your kids to a lot of these things and having them kind of live the lifestyle. So are your kids traveling with you on most of these, or now that school, like, are they school age?
Yeah, they don't go a lot. My family, they catch quite a few in Canada. Like I said, they go to all the winter rodeos for the winter. And then, I'll take the kids one or one or two times a year. You know, I'm just me and the, you know, one of the kids, and they'll go with me for a week or so. But for the most part, they're at home, and we're out here doing this. But get to bring them with us for this week to Pendleton, and you know, it's awesome. Pretty fun 10 days. Get bring the family and hang out and do this with you guys.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to let my wife know when I get back and talk to her that you're gone for 250 days a year. See if I don't know if it'll help at all.
It'll make your week long elk hunt look a lot better.
There you go. Yeah, it will. So we talked about injuries earlier. One of the questions I asked, so how long into the future do you foresee yourself doing this? Do you have like a set date? Is it just until your body holds up, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, I don't really have any set date. I think my body will always be there. I don't think the bronchitis will go away. It'll probably be a matter of just, you know, getting over the travel and not wanting to be gone from my family and, want to be home and do that thing a little more.
Yeah. Will there be any competitive decision? Like if you want to be, are you that guy that wants to be able to compete, or you're like, was that going to aid in the decision? If you're not at the top of your game, like you are right now, is it going to make that decision easier?
I want to go out on top for sure. I don't want to fizzle out and go out, you know, somebody that they didn't remember used to be good, you know?
Yeah. So here at Meat Eater, we encourage everyone, go follow Zeke's journey to the 2023 NFR. Where are you sitting at currently on points for this year?
I think I'm like right there, second and third.
Second and third.
So, yeah.
So if you go in second and third, there's still a way you can win. Does it start fresh, the 15 guys?
Oh, yeah, you can win. Yeah, anybody, if you make it, if you show up there, you have a chance.
To win
last year, I come from 116,000 back and got it done. So
it's basically the aggregate of everything you won up till September and then what you add on at the NFR?
Yep. So 10 rounds, 30,000 a round. The average pays 72,000, I think. The average is the highest score on 10 head or 9 head or whatever, whoever has that.
Yep.
And so there's some money to be won out there, and we're qualified, so if we get out there and get it going.
Yeah, so follow Zeke, 2023 NFR. If you want to root for someone who's a hunter, open the door for your mom. Just be a great salt of the earth guy. Zeke's your guy to root for. Zeke, tell people how they can find out more about you, follow you.
You can catch me on Instagram. I think it's official Zeke Thurston. I got a Facebook page. I don't run it a lot, but we're on social media. Check us out, look us up, give us a follow.
Yeah. Well, we wish you luck here on Saturday. I'm going to get terminology all wrong. You're in the short, or how does
short round?
The short round.
The finals or whatever you want to
say. So that was like 120 of you have rode throughout the week, and then they take the top 12 scores, and then you all get to ride again Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, good luck on that Saturday. Wish you the best of luck. Really appreciated having you on the show today, and we'll be here rooting for you.
Hey, awesome. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and this was a lot of fun.
And thank you.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's O'ReillyAuto.com/meateater.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again.
People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way that they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
Welcome back to a special edition to Cutting the Distance. We're just going to do a quick recap here. Just got done here in Oregon, hunting in one of the big three, I guess. But it wasn't as easy as everybody liked to make it out as. It was a pretty tough hunt. I'm joined here with Brian Sanders, Oregon Backcountry Outfitters, and David Frame, who is my camera guy in this hunt. We're just going to kind of go through the recap, try to figure out the positives of this hunt, and then a lot of the negatives and some of the difficulties and struggles we had on this hunt. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hi, Phelps.
Thanks, Jason.
So, Brian, you guide in this unit, as well as the Winnaha, Walla Walla, kind of all across Eastern Oregon. It's a good hunt. It's got good bulls in it, but it's not necessarily what it's made out to be. It's a lot more difficult than just getting a tag in the big three, thinking you're going to find a big bull behind every corner. Kind of what's your opinion on this unit and kind of what people can expect if they are to draw this tag?
I'm Oregon Backcountry Outfitting, by the way, folks. Oh, but
Outfitters and Outfitting, it's close
kind
enough.
Of similar in Jason's world. Yeah. I think that the reputation is a little bit false on how great the unit is, how many quality bulls there are, how much privacy you're going to have in the woods, that other hunters, all of the things. I personally think Mount Emily is probably one of the worst because of the access. You can almost access everywhere in Mount Emily. You can go to the same point that every other hunter can. You can bugle in archery season and get an answer below you, behind you, beside you, what have you. I just think that it's a little bit, I don't know, it's pretty tough. And the quality of bulls is a little bit tough too. You know, we think of Oregon's big three and everybody's thinking 380 plus bulls. And the fact is you're looking at 320 bulls nonstop. You know, they just are cookie cutter bulls. Every time you hear a bugle, he comes in, he's 315, 320. I mean, you get the 340s on occasion, but it just starts getting fewer and fewer. There's some amazing bulls killed in each of the units in the big three, but far less every year with the impact the wolves are now having. It's tough.
Yep. And that was one of the things we noticed right off the bat on this hunt is you're kind of balancing quantity of bulls in some areas. In this unit, it seems like a lot of the bulls want to end up in the same spot, or you go deep to some of these spots that might have fewer elk, less people, but then you're getting maybe one play a day because you're not on as many elk. And in those spots that have the high quantity, typically easier to get to, it seems like. And then there are guys everywhere. Some of the stuff that, you know, we hunted back in 2019, there are trucks and people everywhere. There's no way, as you mentioned, this unit, there's roads everywhere, at least where I could hunt on this tag. There are some conditions on the tag that I had specifically. You just cannot get away from the people. And it was very apparent right off the bat, these elk are call shy. You could do everything right and they're not going to come in. They've been called to and been winded. They've been called to and been seen. And you're kind of fighting all of this as the hunt goes on.
Yeah, I agree. I think that most of the real big cow groups are in those areas that are easy to access because the cows are kind of using that easier terrain, you know, the deep canyons, the kind of pockets that hold 8 or 10 cows. There's one bull, two bulls with them instead of there being 8 or 10 bulls that's working 70 cows. So that's the tough end of that. And like you said, they are call shy. I mean, and I think that there might be a few factors in that. I think that the wolves have changed their habits a little bit over the last few years, because you'll be on bulls that are just screaming one night. The wolves come through that night. The next day, for 2-3 days in a row, you don't hear a peep. I mean, they're still communicating, obviously, body language, but they just kind of, they kind of get paranoid for a few days. But I agree. The hunters, you know, it takes so long to get this tag. I think that you get a few hunters that are less experienced than other hunters that go over the counter every year, year after year. They're avid bow hunters. They don't maybe have the call experience that yourself does. And they do. They sound a little bit off as far as elk sounds go. And they get call shy. They get winded. They get seen, like you said. So it makes it tough.
And you know, I had to refer to Dave multiple times on this hunt. Like, a guy that's supposed to have all these answers, right, when it comes to calling elk, I would look at Dave like, do you think we should cow call to this one, or should we beagle to it? Because we were just getting beat so many times. It's like when you thought in a normal situation that we should get in close and beagle because it's a herd bull, he would take his cows. And then it's like, all right, next time we're going to go on in this herd bull, we're going to cow call. That didn't seem to work. And so it had me even questioning, these bulls were so call shy. Like, how do you approach these? You know, I asked you on the phone because you had some success earlier in the week calling in, you know, quite a few bulls. And I'm like, Brian, what are you doing, you know, to get these in? We were just kind of talking back and forth. And, you know, you were playing the game the right way. You know, you started with a cow call and they answered, but it was seemed to be few and far between where you'd actually get the bulls to play the right game. Me and Dave had a couple good hunts, more of the remote stuff where people hadn't messed with these elk, but you were only dealing with one bull, maybe one herd bull, no satellites, or the one herd bull that we did get on had a few satellites, and it just made it tough. You're either in not very many elk, or you were in, a bunch of elk with a bunch of people. And so you're trying to weigh that decision on be in the middle of elk or be by yourself. And like Dave is, I love Dave as a camera guy because he's a very, I mentioned in the last podcast, he's a pretty smart elk hunter. He gets it. He's a great guy to bounce ideas off of, but there were just times where, you know, there were days where we dropped 1500 feet into a canyon or 1,000 feet and like we were going for broke. And then there are other times where, we just didn't know what to do at times. And we kind of had to change our mentality here the last couple of days when we finally got it done. But, what do you think, Dave? What was your takeaway from this hunt as far, you know, of course you're behind the camera a lot, but you get to make the same decisions and be in the same scenario as I am. What's your opinion of the big three? You grew up in the Blues, but on the Washington side, it's a special place to you, but the elk hunting, I don't want to say it's overrated. It's a great spot to hunt elk, especially in comparison. So I'm not sounding ungrateful, but it's just maybe not what it's made out to be at times. It can be good, but.
Yeah. These Oregon units are a little different than the Washington side. Just a lot more hunters. You're definitely hunting pressured elk, super call shy, and then throw in inconsistent winds in there and it's a pretty hard hunt. Towards the end there, we were pretty much just going silent and trying to get as close as we could, almost hunting them like muleys.
Yeah. We definitely had to change our tactics there a little bit as the hunt went on. We, you know, it's like, dang, you know, my calls sound good. Like they would locate, but when you would get in tight, I didn't know what the right answer was. And so ultimately we went to a little bit of spot and stalk with maybe a few cow calls and in certain situations. And it made it rough. And the other downside is, and my numbers might be a little bit iffy, but there's about 55 tags given in Emily. Is that right, Brian?
I think the 55, yeah, somewhere in there.
And that's, so 55, and that's big bull tags, but then they give out 300 spike tags.
Yeah, they give out a bunch of spike tags, so that doesn't help things.
And we're these spike guys, you hunt spike bulls, you find spike bulls just like you do big bulls, right? You're locating the herd bulls, the satellites, and you're moving on these herds trying to call these spikes away. So in my opinion, you've really got 355 guys out in the woods, plus or minus a few, you know, state tag holders, you know, guys with tags like mine. You've got 350 people in a unit it is a big, vast unit, but a lot of these guys are concentrated and you've got a lot of guys going after, you know, a fairly small amount of bulls when it all boils down to it. And it just makes that pressure really, real tough.
Yeah, I agree. And the Winalha Walla Walla, I think, is a little bit better, but yeah, it's pretty tough. You get all them guys attacking the same herds and They get call shy fast.
Yep. I'm gonna back up a little bit because I think the audience needs to like dial into what you call big bulls. So you know, as an outfitter, you're trying to kill the absolute best bull for your clients, right? And you're a guy that's been lucky enough to kill a lot of big bulls. So I don't want to discredit the unit for not having what most people would consider like bulls of a lifetime, you know, at that 320, 340. But you're talking about trying to find those bulls that are at a very upper end. You're looking for 350 plus, and you're even trying to find a few of those 380 to 400 type bulls in some of these units. So break that down. Kind of, we've had this conversation a lot because my definition of a giant is way different than yours. A guy that gets to live here, see a bunch of these bulls. So explain that a little bit, like the percentages, kind of what you can expect to see if you come to Emily. Like, you're probably not going to lay eyes on a 400. Like, explain that hierarchy, you know, the amount of bulls you're going to see, what you can expect to see if you're just a Joe Blow that doesn't do a whole lot of scouting, maybe a couple weekends, and, you know, just take it on in September.
Yeah, that's all. I guess I kind of know what you're asking here, but in my opinion, the very first thing I tell my hunters is you have to come with realistic expectations. So your abilities have to align with your expectations, number one. And number two, you're exactly right. When I say big bulls, you know, in my head, just because we work hard and we're a little bit spoiled at being able to be out in the woods all the time. So we are looking for that 350, 360, and even a lot bigger, like you say, for some statewide auction tags, things like that. But when you come to this unit, you're going to see that 320 bull. And as Jason said, that is a bull of a lifetime. I mean, that is realistic expectations for all these big three units. I always tell my hunters, you know, this is our goal, but this is realistic expectations. You come to this unit and 320, 330 bulls are the big bulls. You know, they're genetics, especially on the Mount Emily side or some of it, you're not gonna get different genetics that get a lot of inches. So you need to come looking for a mature bull that you're happy with. Don't come looking for inches, you know, don't get stuck on inches because they have to have a bunch of extra stuff. And some of these units don't have it. The genetics just have straight sixes, straight seven, whatever. I mean, is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah. Just what, if a hunter puts in, draws Emily, you know, you see a lot of these, you know, everybody's coming over here. It seems like everybody, if you look at the internet, comes over here and kills a 360 bull, right? It's what it seems like or what they make it seem to believe. But being in the unit three times now, I've hunted with you twice. This year I didn't hunt with you. But the reality is you guys are working your tails off to find a few of these 350, 360 bulls. And the normal guy probably should come over here expecting more realistically. And I think a lot of guys, you know, the ones we've talked to here this week, they're happy with those 320 bulls. But I think where a guy may go wrong, or a gal, whoever's here, is you know, passing on what they would see as a 323, because you might not get another chance at something better, is the reality. Like, a 320 bull is probably what most people, you know, are going to have a chance at, you know, those bigger mature satellite bulls.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. If you got a 320 bull and you have this tag, it's a shooter. I mean, 9 out of 10 times, unless you've done your scouting or you have a target bull in mind, which, as you said, we work our tails off, so we have some target bulls in mind, and we're targeting those bulls specifically, and we're not going to shoot until we kill one of them, unless we're running out of time or just capabilities. So you come to the big three, I would say any of the big three, a 320 bull's a trophy bull. And I mean, it wasn't very many years ago, a 300-inch bull wasn't even heard of, really. So I think just, you're right on, expectations need to be more realistic.
Yep.
It's just a little bit blown out. And I think that a lot of people even sell it as that, but it's definitely a 340 and under unit.
Yeah, I'm with a few exceptions that,
exactly,
that'll hit the hood above that mark. And it's got the ability to grow them, but it takes a lot of age. It takes some special genetics. All of those things have to kind of add up to get that bull there. And then they're, like you say, they probably make up, what, 1% or 2% of the bulls in the entire unit?
I would say, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to jump over and talk to Dave here a little bit about kind of what we went through on this hunt. A lot of ups and downs. We had good weather to start with, but it seemed like we were in an area, some of the spots we wanted to hunt right off the bat, very, very overpressured. We thought we were in there deep, ran into two firefighters from Eugene area. It's like, dang it. You know, we thought we had all of that. And then, you know, later in the hunt, we went more isolated, way out into some deep stuff, long drives, just getting away where we could hunt in the unit, and a lot less bulls. We, you know, that one day I think we did what, 14, 15 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. We got on what, 2 bulls that entire day.
Yep.
So a lot of boot leather to find just a few bulls. And it's new country. We hadn't been in there. We didn't really know how the wind laid in. And then progressing through the hunt, we hit it weird where it was nice one day, rain the next day, nice the other. So we had all these different systems moving in. And I'm this is all joking, but at one point I about threw my bow down the mountain because we would literally try to walk 360 degrees around the bull, and you could, where you were trying to get to, you maybe heard a bull beagle or whatever, you were trying to get to a spot and you could not keep the wind right. I know one time, you know, because you can feel the wind in your face as you walk, you know, we've all did that before, but I would puff my wind and be like, all right, we're good. I'd give Dave a thumbs up. And then he would 10 seconds later, he would look at me and then he'd puff his wind and it was hitting us in the back, you know, and we fought that all week long or 10 days long. And how frustrating was that, you know, for us? Because I know you could probably sense the frustration with me. You were getting frustrated because, you know, as a camera guy, you have to take all the same steps I do. And so, have you ever played with fickle winds to that extent that we did?
No, I've never seen winds that inconsistent before. And it was pretty frustrating as a cameraman, like bulls and elk all around us, but all week they're just out of arm's reach as far as like getting footage of them and stuff.
Yeah.
Filming them here and there at half mile away with long lens, but those call-ins are pretty sweet to get on film, and it was just hard to get those.
I feel a little bit responsible because Dave has talked about this, you know, behind the scenes with me. He's like, I love it because I have always got a tag, but he doesn't necessarily have a tag to kill the animal. He's got a tag to photo it, you know, and I felt bad because we would get on bulls, we could work them, but it seemed like right at the last second they would bump or we would get the wind wrong. And Dave, we just weren't able to capture footage. No fault to you. It was a rough hunt and I feel responsible for that. And then I feel even more responsible at times where we're climbing, you know, 1,000 feet down to go chase a bugle. Maybe a bad decision I made blows them out, and then we're hiking back out and you're there with me, you're kind of getting pulled along. But it's all part of the game. And we were really, really struggling, with that wind. I think we were on elk every morning, every evening, we were playing it right. Just could not seem to get everything to work.
Yeah. We were able to locate elk every day, but, just getting them to play with us, play the game was a struggle.
Yep. And one thing another takeaway, which a lot of people need to recognize, is elk aren't necessarily dumb. Where we were finding the majority of the elk, they seem to be in these pockets where that wind was 360, or there was no way to approach. Any direction you went, you weren't going to get in on them because the wind was eventually going to get to them. It was kind of interesting, you know, something we've always known. They always seem to bed in areas where they can't, you know, where you can't sneak in on them. But a lot of these areas seem to be really, really, you know, in flats or pockets or bowls where the wind would just swirl and hit them. And then yesterday, a lot of these hunts come down to a series of decisions, right? Are you going to take the day off? Are you going to take it easy? Are you going to go hard every day after day? And one thing we should talk about is just like the physical demand that this unit will put on you. There are some easy spots to hunt, but if you're going to get into some of the steep, breaky country, it's going to wear you down, and you need to be able to come to this unit and do it day after day. And I don't, you know, you're in great shape. We were able to make it, but you know, there was a lot of effort put in for some days that just didn't really pan out or materialize anything.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of vertical, in this country, and, just a lot of work, a lot of miles.
And then going back to that decision-making, all these little decisions yesterday, you can kind of, I don't know if it was a sense of urgency. We had what, 4 days, 5 days left, but yesterday, if you look on, you know, you've got a smartwatch, I've got an iPhone, you start to look at what we did yesterday, we were to the point where we needed to like hit that turbo mode, right? We needed to just go. We needed to give more than we had been. And so we started bugling off into the steep country and we were chasing every bugle. Like, oh, that one's too hard to get to. We're not going to go chase that. So we went after every single bull we heard yesterday. And just kind of gave it our all. You were even, and this is where having, you're not necessarily a hunting partner, you were more of my camera guy, but we were hunting together. You know, sometimes I would pick you like, hey, I think we should do this. And then you were like, hey, Phelps, we should definitely go bugle off here. And it was a lot of that back and forth, kind of keeping each other positive and like, hey, we need to go try this, that really kind of added to our success.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was fun getting to help out on the hunt in this hunt. And
Yeah. And And so I'm gonna kind of wrap this up with how we ultimately killed this bull. I can't remember a bull that I've never called in with archery equipment. And as we were grinding last night, it was just before 6 o'clock. We had literally an hour of daylight. We had stopped down one little side road. You know, we're driving down the road looking at Onyx. Dave's like, well, this kind of gets us above that one area we'd been hunting, or we had checked out the first day and never been back to. We you know, hurry out there. We check for bugles, and we get two different bulls bugling, and we drop pins. We're like, well, the wind's bad. We're above them. Let's boogie around. And we were kind of calculating, like, all right, we can get back to the truck in 5 minutes. We can get down there in 10, and it's going to be tight, like real close to dark. And so we made it. And then we're able to kind of fly up the ridge, especially for my pace, get there fairly quickly, got parked, made it all the way to the bull. And the nice thing was, this bull was bugling on his own occasionally, not very, feverishly, wasn't bugling all the time, but he would give us just enough. We knew about where he was. On this instance, I elected to not make any calls. We had a lot of wind. The wind was blowing down. It would let us be pretty quiet, go undetected. But we were able to follow this bugle, and we get up to this meadow, beautiful meadow, and I spot a cow maybe 120 yards away.
Yep.
And we're kind of like, all right, we got to slow down. We got to kind of get our heads, our bodies out of the way so she can't see us. And about that time, we spotted some horn movement. This bull was bedded down, and thankfully he was on our side of the meadow, not the far, not the edge. He was right in line with that cow. At that time it was about 70 yards away maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Fortunately had a pine tree, and me and Dave do some real quiet talking and hand motions. I'm like, let's get behind me. We'll walk in a single file line. And thank God this tree was big, because I'm a fairly big guy, and I was able to just keep that bull's head behind a pine tree. We had a couple loud ass sticks we had to, and trees and stuff to get over. We were able to see the bull's head. And a lot of times when a bull's bedded, you can't really tell real easily if he's looking at you or away from you. You're trying to figure out what's going on, which direction he's facing. And we kind of get in a straight line, and we just start moving towards him. And the nice thing was, is you could see his horns out one side of the tree as you were walking. So you could tell if he was picking up on your sound, your noise. We get through the sketchy section of that tree, and he's still, everything's good. I'm ranging it. We're at 49, 50, and I'm like, I want to get to 40. That way, when he gets up out of his bed, we had about a half hour of daylight left, and wanted him to get out of his bed on his own without having to make a cow call. And we get to just under 40 of the tree, but I figured he's bedded past the tree, so he's going to be a little bit, maybe right at 40, maybe just a little bit over when he gets up. And we were in a section of pine trees, and anybody that's hunted pine trees knows if you drop to your knees, you're now able to shoot under him. And he was under a pine tree. We'll be able to shoot under the limbs to him. And I wasn't as graceful as I wanted to be going to my, down on my knees. And that bull kind of caught some noise, but just like we've talked with Brian multiple times, he almost thinks that just walking around at times and letting that bull hear you walk, he bugled. As soon as I got to my knees, like, he turned our way, but then he bugled. Like, it didn't scare him. It didn't bother him. He bugled at us and then slowly got out of his bed and walked to his left.
I remember the wind a couple of times was on our back, and it was like, oh, well, count down to 5 seconds and he's going to be out of here.
Yeah. I was very ready to shoot quick. And I remember looking back at Dave, like, gosh, dang it. We just need this wind to hold. But it was one of those times where the wind was predominantly downslope the whole time, but we were getting uphill pushes because these systems were moving in, kind of changing the wind. And I think we got lucky because the wind would blow up, but then it would switch and come back down and wouldn't let that wind get to him. So we risked a little bit. That bull gets up. I had a very narrow shooting lane, probably 12 inches wide at the bull. I was able to get drawn and settled, fortunately, very quick. Dave, I was able to rewatch the footage. Dave is able to like time it perfectly as I get my bow drawn. Dave, like, we're perfectly in line because we were both behind the tree. Dave just like inches out to the right, maybe 8 inches, and gets the shot and everything on film. Had a little bit of a rough go, no blood for 150 yards, hit the bull really well. We finally start picking up blood. We follow his tracks to the point where we've got blood, and, we made a bad decision at this very point in our night. I'm going to blame it on Dave. As we were getting ready, Dave's like, are we leaving the packs here? I'm like, yeah, let's go. No, I take all responsibility. I said, let's leave the packs here. I hate, it's just nice sometimes to be able to go light and nimble. Beagle tube bow. Dave grabs his camera and a change of batteries, and we're out. We realized that searching for blood with your iPhone light is not the greatest. The greatest solution to tracking blood. We get on some real good blood. It's got bubbles in it. We know we're either in lungs or heart. Everything's looking real good. He bleeds great for 100 yards?
Yeah, I think so. 100, 150. Yeah.
I'm kind of down in the dumps, even though I pride myself in blood tracking. Dave took the lead because I was a little discouraged with the blood trail and a little just like, hey, this is best just to let Dave lead it. Like, you're doing a great job. I helped a couple times where we'd lose some blood. My light was a little bit brighter, was able to pick up some blood. And we get to a point where we got our last few specs and there's just nothing. And my good buddy, Brian Sanders, text me, and we didn't have very good service. It just somehow randomly got through, like, hey, update. And I was able to get a call out real quick to him, and it wasn't a great call. If he would have been quiet and let me talk, he asked me, why didn't you shoot the bull? He asked me why I didn't have my bow drawn back, if I could get my bow drawn back. He asked me all these dumb questions, and by the time I lost reception, I couldn't give him a pin or tell him where we were at. So then we needed to back out anyways, because we didn't have good lights and it was supposed to rain at 11. This is about 8:30. We climbed back up to the meadow where we shot him, had good service, was able to get a phone call into Brian, and he was going to come up with lights and maybe bring our packs up, but I couldn't tell if I could get my truck unlocked from up there using the old Ford password. We're going to use technology, like, hey Brian, I'm going to unlock my truck for you. So I call him back, like, hey Brian, we'll just meet you at the truck. It's only a mile walk down, maybe. And we'll just meet you at the truck. We're going to charge our phones, get our packs, and we'll meet you and come back. So we asked for some water because I was pretty low on water. And I'm almost positive that Brian set me up here. So I'm dying. I needed some water. And Brian's like, no, don't take it out of this plastic jug. Take it out of this black thermos. He's like, that one, it's heavier. I don't want to pack that. I pour this into my water bottle and almost burnt my hand. It was so hot. And he swears he didn't do it on purpose, but I'm positive he did.
I didn't. I won't say either way. I would say Jason and I have a special friendship.
So I head back up on the mountain with boiling hot water, but we regroup. He brings his brother. Me and Dave go back up. We now have our headlamps. We've got bright lights. We head back in there. And me and Dave are never, ever going to live this down. He thinks we set him up. We had already found the bull, maybe, and just called him up there to help pack. But we get to the last blood, and there's an obvious, I mean, when you track bulls, there's an obvious direction they're going, right? We were kind of on it, and we were sitting there. I was still standing at last blood trying to get my pack all situated. Brian walks down. He's complaining, which is typical of Brian. Not really. He's tough as nails, but Brian's like, is it all this freaking brushy down here? I think you got to that edge, right? And you're like, is it all this crappy? And I'm like, yeah, at least in that pocket, you can go left or right of that. And it wasn't less than a half a minute later. Brian's like, your bull's right down here dead. Explain your theory and how you stumbled into it.
Well, I kind of told Jason that they have hooves and the hooves make tracks. And if you just follow the tracks from last blood, you'll find your dead bull. But he kind of disagreed with me. He claims that he did, but.
I claim that you didn't follow its tracks. You just stumbled into it because you came a different direction and found the blood later. But regardless, there were elk tracks.
Anybody knows me, I'm like the littlest human compared to Jason, and he couldn't see me through all that brush. So he has no idea which direction I came from.
I didn't find the bull, so I'm not trying to like make excuses for myself. But Dave, we were probably 5 yards away from that. We thought that there was a bear. I thought he had tumbled, which he didn't. He never did tumble. He went to his bed, lay down, and died. But right above that, there was an old log tore apart. And I'm like, oh, it looks like he tumbled through here, Dave. And I went down there with my little iPhone light earlier, like, there's nothing. And it was literally, you pushed through that brush and he was laying there dead.
No, yeah, you guys were right on track. Yeah, just you didn't have lights, and it's nice to have fresh eyes and a positive attitude and all the things.
you bring a positive attitude wherever
always.
You go, Brian.
Yeah.
No, it was awesome to have you guys there. Brian's pretty damn handy with a knife. His brother Justin was awesome. Dave's a pack animal. He's always taking care of the situation. He's grabbing bags, legs, taking video pictures, doing his job while we're trying to cut up meat. So it was an awesome little team there to finish that up. And Brian asked if I could tell everybody how much weight he packed out on the pack out, because he's he's wanting everybody to know how tough he is. But Brian took all the
We don't need to tell anybody anything. Everybody packed a bowl out. It was fun.
We all packed a bowl. It was a great night. But Brian, for being at, 150 pounds, maybe, soaking wet, he probably had 150 pounds on his pack. I really appreciate all the help. You know, Dave, Justin, you guys all packed Hines. I had the head and a front shoulder. And we made pretty quick time out. From the time we left the truck, 9:45, we were back at the truck by 11:45. It was a hustle in. We broke them
we
down
beat
really
the
quick
by like 5 minutes.
Yep. So yeah. it was a great hunt. Had to change tactics a little bit. So, you know, we always talk about being aggressive, getting close. In the situation where it's just not working, I encourage anybody to change up tactics and do what you have to do to find success. But I can't thank you enough, Brian, for helping. You know, Pac, thank for coming on here today and talking about the big three. And as always, Dave, you take twice as many steps as I do on these hunts and don't ever get to pull the trigger, but you get to hit the record button. And really appreciate you having you here. So thanks, everybody. That was just a real quick add-on to Cutting the Distance. Just wanted to give a quick update from the field on my Oregon archery elk hunt. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.